back with more of the Stuhr Crazy podcast. I am joined today by the curator of Stuhr Museum, Carrie Stouffer, and the director of interpretation here at Stuhr Museum, Casanova. Welcome to you both back to the podcast.
Nice to be here.
Thanks.
So I figured I'd just bring you two both into the same conversation in this episode because the topic that we are discussing, the Transcontinental Railroad, is, you know, it has a local story and it has a national story as well. And, you know, Hall County is right in the middle of things. So let's just dig in and not break it up and talk about the whole thing.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a good way to go.
Yeah. So just for, you know, an introductory note, what is the Transcontinental Railroad and why was it built and when? Well, let's start there.
Well,
anybody can answer. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll work off each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Transcontinental Railroad was something that, you know, was thought the whole purpose was to bring the West and the East together and combine all of that commerce. And there were so many goals to do that. And then there were a lot of obstacles as well. So you want to start talking about the middle 1800s
and what was going on? They actually start looking at the possibility of constructing this in 1836. Mm-hmm. They start working on that, having public meetings and taking a lot of things into consideration. The Senate starts approving or considering appropriations in 1860. And granting subsidies. They at one point in time appropriated $96 million for the construction. So, and all of the meetings and everything, I guess from what I read, constituted 11 published volumes about all the meetings. So, you know, we talk about having long meetings. It's like, yeah, can you imagine all that? We have 11 volumes worth of meetings. Notes. It takes a long time before they get started.
Yeah.
And once
there's a lot going on right there with the Civil War, I think.
Yeah, but it doesn't slow it down that much. It only stops it for a brief period of time.
Well, and I think that's because there was so much advantage to mm-hmm. the North and so much that was built in with politics and keeping it going and getting Abraham Lincoln to get on board with it.
And he was really on board with it. And it was viewed as a way to connect and keep the people of the West Coast or the Pacific Coast in the Union.
Yeah.
Yeah, and really take that commerce mm-hmm. and move it across the country for the benefit of the North.
Of the nation,
yes. But, you know, there was mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, well, for that
motivation. Yeah. Kind of that adrenaline.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, go ahead, yeah.
No. Go for it.
I was just going to say, like, and kind of just keep in mind what that nation is that we're talking about at this point, 1830s, 1840s. You know, you have already by, I think, around the time of this construction of the Transcontinental Railroad, there are 9,000 miles of train already laid, track laid already in the East.
East, yeah.
But, you know, we have this vast American desert right in the middle.
The big empty,
and then you have California on the other side, mm-hmm. and that California's already a state by 1845, I want to say.
Yeah, it's in the 40s.
So, yeah, something right there in the 1840s.
So Apologies to California.
You have these two kind of sections who are both one country, and they're divided by, you know, distance and time and communication, and they're just, at some point, I think it was probably clear to everybody, there was going to need to be some kind of
connection
so you don't have to go thousands of miles around the southern coast of South America to get to California or through the Isthmus of Panama and risk all kinds of...
Yeah, can you imagine trudging across the isthmus to get on another boat to finish the sail?
Well, and what you're talking about is to go around the Cape of Africa or to go through Panama... is safer and a better option than to just go across the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to, there's an amazing concept.
Many different ways to get there, but, you know, each of them takes its own time.
Yeah, and, you know,
and risk.
At the very least, several weeks to get from one side to the other. Once this is completed, the Transcontinental Railroad, it cuts that time from the East to California to under a week, and it makes travel infinitely less expensive to mm-hmm. to cover that same distance
and comfortable as well. And you know, many more items that can be shipped that are large, that mm-hmm. are heavy, that are bulky.
Well, and talk about, you know, we kind of reel sometimes at the change in technology that we experience as modern people. But think about going from having to walk or go by wagon to get anywhere, to get anything of significance or something like that. Then all of a sudden the railroad comes through, and now all you have to do is hop on a train. You can go east, you can go west.
Mm-hmm.
And it only takes a few days as opposed to the months on end that they took to originally get here.
Absolutely. Well, and then the things that you can order.
Yeah.
And you don't have to wait for some family member to happen to put it on your wagon or something that, you know, is going through Wells Fargo or anything like that. All of a sudden you're like, hey, here's a catalog.
Yeah.
I want that. I want those peaches.
probably the thing that was most significant for some people is going to be the very real possibility that they could actually see family again. They could get on a train.
That's a really good point.
And go see family when they thought at one point in time they might never see them again.
Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, as you say that, and I have goosebumps, and you know, we think about we haven't watched our seen family members for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
There's that opposite side of it where there is a bunch of people who lived here who also saw it as the biggest threat.
Yeah.
Because it was going to be. They could see in their minds that this was going to take away
it was going to their homes. It was going to change things. It was going to change things, and change it did.
You're specifically, I think, talking probably about Native Americans.
Absolutely.
Or do you want to delve into that a little bit further? I mean, I know that there were, you know, several tribes that resisted that kind of westward expansion, and not just with the railroad, but in every which way you can imagine. But with the railroad specifically, I know that there were fights and skirmishes that broke out that were...
Yeah, so you have the Central Railroad, who's coming from the west, and then you have the Union Pacific that's coming from the east, and specifically the Union, because they're going past, you know, they start in Omaha, and they're
They're going through mainly Pawnee lands, but you also have the encroachment of the Lakota and some of the other tribes as they're being pushed central at that time.
What I found interesting is that, you know, there are mentions of the Sioux, the Cheyenne, and the Arapaho specifically going and attacking trains because they see it as a threat. But you also have instances of the Pawnee, who's really, that tribe is particular to here in the Platte River, actually working with the U.S. Cavalry to get the train to go through.
Yeah, the Pawnee Scouts.
And so it's a lot of rich history and a lot of, you know, the emotions that the railroad...
Yeah, I think
drew it, I think up in so many different ways is
underappreciated history.
I think
a lot of people don't really realize just an impact that all of this had.
Well, and the speed at which it was accomplished too, I think, is really difficult to comprehend. You're talking about going from, and maybe we should just say that, like, we're going from Council Bluffs / Omaha to Sacramento, California, starting in at each.
One
team starting in the east, one team starting in the west, and let's see when we can meet in the middle,
We'll figure out where we're going to meet.
Yeah, and...
And by the way, we get more money the faster in the
morning.
Exactly. And that was it was designed as a competition from the beginning to see, you know, who could get it done, or who could get the most mileage because they got paid by the mile, and, you know, that's a whole different can of worms. But, in between 1862 and 1869, this, you know, they're... carving through mountains, literally. And
7 years.
Yeah.
Give or take.
And really, it doesn't really ramp up until the Civil War concludes.
They kind of get going a little bit again in 62, but they really can't take off until after the war is concluded.
I found a few articles, actually, just kind of doing some digging in the newspapers. And they have these, like, really cool construction updates about where the railroad is in 1866, and you can just kind of follow along with them week by week. I have one from June, one from July, one from August, and they're all in 1866. And, you know, one says in Omaha in June, the Union Pacific has 50 miles of railroad iron and ties to lay on 70 miles of the road, besides 60,000 ties yet up the river, and which will be brought down as fast as steamers can carry them. Choppers are in the woods in every direction, getting more out to keep up the supply as fast as the energetic constructors can put them down on the roadbed and spike the iron to them. The rapidity with which the road is being constructed keeps everybody in a state of astonishment. Like in 1860s, I mean, it just seems like there's just...
energy.
This, avalanche of energy.
And, you know, again, a dichotomy of energy. Because, you know, when you're looking at the Central Railroad, they had a slower start, I think. And there's, you know, four guys that have really taken on and bought the stocks and what they needed to get it started. And there was a little bit of turmoil. And they had a hard time finding the energetic workers that would do it.
But once they did.
Once they connected into the Chinese and got
on
them
side.
On board.
And Irish.
Yeah.
The Irish
was kind of more on the Union Pacific. But, I mean, that was a huge way to get through those mountains.
The
dynamite and...
That is a really complex issue. And I think upwards of 85 to 90% of the laborers who completed the Central Pacific Line were Chinese hired laborers. Some were nationals.
Until they got to Utah.
Until then you have the Mormon influence from Brigham Young and that recruitment strategy. A lot were nationals who were already living in California. Some were also from the mainland. And that really, I mean, the Chinese Exclusion Act doesn't happen until 1882. And after that is... There's already a lot of negative Chinese sentiment before that, but
because it's just like any other immigrant group that comes in, they're viewed as the enemy because they're going to take our jobs and,
exactly.
and all this other stuff, despite the fact that there's probably not a lot of people who want to do the very hard work that they ended up doing.
Yeah, they had trouble finding people that would do the Central Railroad line. So.
Yeah, and the reason that they hired so many Chinese laborers is because they were oftentimes willing to undertake those very difficult jobs.
And dangerous.
Dangerous jobs for the lower pay.
Yeah,
and actually had the knowledge of how to get through the mountain. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, really there's a lot there that to be grateful for and yet also probably to apologize for.
The people coming from the east really had the easier route till they got to a certain point, so.
Yeah, and I mean, from the east, you know, we touched on the Chinese story. 8,000 Irish, German, and Italian immigrants are really the majority of workforce going west. And you can see that in the newspapers as well. There's a general call. I have all these newspapers, so I just want to like find a way to read about them. But like, there's wanted signs in the newspaper, I guess, for what they're who they're calling for. And one from April in 1866 was wanted immediately to go to Grand Island, 150 choppers, good wages offered and prompt pay guaranteed. For further particulars, contact this person in Wood River.
What year was that one?
1866.
Yeah, because any tree that they could come across, they were chopping down around here.
Yeah.
They denuded the area along the Platte.
Right.
I found this letter from 1867 that was written by a worker on the Union Pacific Railroad that was in our archive. Kay, have you read this?
I'm not sure which one is it from. I've seen it. It's been a long time since I looked at it.
It is not named. There is no name at the bottom of it, but it's a very genuine, heartfelt letter that's dated December of 1867. It is in a very rough cursive, so it's kind of difficult to kind of sit with. So I'll try my best to read just a bit of it. But he says, it's a strange place that I am upon the railroad at work. My family are at Peru and probably will be throughout the winter. I am in rather a lonesome country. Upon this vast plains, there are hundreds of thousands of acres of land here that is not fit for cultivation and will lay to the waste for a certainty. As far as the eye can reach, it is one level plains of nothing for the eye to rest upon, but one sea of desert land. Okay, and it goes. it's very bleak, and he's clearly out on this. You know, he's at Grand Island Station, I should have said, in 1867.
Because that's what they called it at first, was Grand Island Station.
Yeah.
Instead of Grand Island.
So his opinion of writing home and his family is in Peru is, wow, guys, I don't know who's coming here and why we're doing this, but we're doing it, and it's...
Did it because of the railroad.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they...
A lot of people looked at it here because of the railroad.
Company specifically went to Schleswig-Holstein and said, the railroad's going to come through here. Here's the survey of this area. This is what's going to happen.
They must have read the 11 volumes.
Right. And then to actually read what happens when they get here is amazing, because it's not all gumdrops and lollipops.
Yeah, no peaches and cream or anything.
Well,
like
and
that.
Honestly, the Civil War kind of helps in a weird way this to happen, because there is this big dispute that's happening throughout the 1850s. You know, the South wants the path of the railroad to go through the South. They want it to go.
Everybody wants the path to go through their state.
Exactly. Yeah. And as soon as the Southern states secede, that argument essentially is tabled. And it's like, okay, well, you're not involved anymore.
Obviously,
so.
You're not going to be part of this decision. We're going to
can't even be
one.
Really part of the Homestead Act. Yeah. I mean, there's just a million ramifications.
Yeah.
And then you see it, and it goes through, you know, starting in Council Bluffs through Nebraska, through Wyoming, through Utah, through Nevada, through California. It could have just as easily gone through, you know, Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, or something along that.
Which would have been the more advantageous weather route. Mm-hmm. But they say specifically that they did not look at the path with the least obstacles or the favorable grades or anything like that. It was not the people who made the decisions were the money people, and not necessarily the people who said, engineering-wise, this would be the better path.
Well, I think there was only one engineer among those early people that really were pushing.
But
the actual...
Granville Dodge was really a big mover and shaker behind all that.
Yeah, he has a great quote that kind of talks about that, the path itself.
Yeah.
And not to just be the guy who's like reading stuff that I found this whole podcast. The path, I think, that really ties this this story to our current time right now, the Transcontinental Railroad with 2022 in Hall County, Nebraska, Dodge says that after this kind of path was laid out, he recognized that it followed the Great Platte Valley Route, which was made by the Buffalo. It was next used by the Indians. It was then used by the fur traders, next by the Mormons, then by the overland immigration trail to California and to Oregon. He stops the quote there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's largely the same route that the Pony Express follows.
Yep.
It's then the Transcontinental Railroad. And now today it's Interstate 80, largely, that it goes through the exact same states on largely the same parallel.
And who knows
what
it'll be next.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know what the telegraph lines were.
Well, the telegraph lines kind of followed where the railroad went.
Well, there you go.
So it kind of followed the same path. I mean, there were some deviations, but tended to follow that.
Well, you know, and I think there socially, you know, there's the town building and all of that too. But then socially, some of those towns, especially from the Union side that coming to the West, that's where the Wild West was.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can actually follow kind of the deviancy and that mythology with the railroad.
Yeah, depending on where you were with that.
But you can also do that with I-80 now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with the different towns. And so it does, there's a definitely repeatable, I think, patterns with that kind of thing.
And as all of these paths transpire, that's where community development tended to take place. Mm-hmm. Now, in Hall County's particular case, the Davenport settlers actually settled away from what later became Grand Island Station, but they picked up and literally moved buildings to where Grand Island Station was in order to become part of that community, because they knew that the railroad was going to make the community grow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that happened to so many towns. It
made or broke them.
Yeah, I mean, and at a time where they haven't started yet even. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of these little settlements from here all the way out west. And the ones that are still here were largely stops along the railroad.
Yeah, specific stops like a water stop or something
Fuel and then the railroad land grants.
Mm-hmm.
Because the railroad said, if you buy this property from us, we'll make sure you have a post office.
Yeah.
And so that is what you need for a town and for a town building.
And the railroad needed to sell that because that's how they financed everything.
Right.
That's why they were granted all that.
And you couldn't really have, you know, something like land grants in the 1860s. You couldn't give this land away unless there was a way for people to cultivate it and get it to towns. And that was only possible through the railroad. So without access to a railroad, in terms of selling product, you really need that.
That's why the towns were spaced in such a way so that a farmer could get to a location and back to their farm to get chores done by the end of the evening. So they were very carefully laid out where all these things went.
Mm-hmm.
What was travel like on these railroads, though? Like, for passengers? Was it immediately comfortable, or was it...
No.
Actually,
it depends on how rich you were.
Exactly. It's just like the Titanic. First class, second class, and third class. Yeah. So if you had the money, the cool thing, I think, about that kind of thing is that it really was if you had the money.
Mm-hmm.
If you were considered a third class person, but you had the money to buy the ticket for first class, that was one of the first times that you were allowed to do that, and you were not regulated.
You got to sit down. You got to experience a little bit of room and everything. It's just like airline travel.
The cushions were velvet. Yeah. Everything was marble.
Mm-hmm.
Even right away.
Window shades. Yeah.
In the 1860s.
Yeah, for the
first
who
trains.
Were well off, yeah, they were really posh.
But then, like Kay was saying, I mean, if you go down to third class, you rode like cattle, and there was not running water, and it was...
You could sit down sometimes, yeah. And having experienced train rides in the past at some historic areas where all of the smoke and everything comes back into the car when you're traveling, there's no cushion, there's no shocks, there's no springs to kind of cushion your ride.
Yeah.
And it's very bumpy. It's very uncomfortable. You have all the smoke billowing back from the locomotive and everything. And it's hot. There's no climate control. It's not a comfortable ride, especially for an extended trip.
Yeah, well, and it's easy to see. Like, if you look in the first class passenger cars, they have the berths and they have the place where you can lay down and all of that. And everything is cushioned and does have springs.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go back and you get to third class, that is just wooden planks.
Hmm.
And so it really is a matter of what kind of ticket you can purchase. One of the things I want to point out is that women, we're looking at, a few years before that really takes off. Well, actually, women's rights, they're starting to make a move.
Yeah, they're working.
But women were not really, I wouldn't say they weren't permitted, but it wasn't looked fondly on for women to travel.
Sure.
Like, you didn't want a woman to, like, get on the stagecoach and go across the country.
It was very uncomfortable because a lot of the amenities that would have made it more comfortable just weren't available.
Right. But with the first class passenger trains, it became more appropriate and acceptable for women to travel, which opened up...
A big can of worms.
For property... For acquiring some of these land grants, for moving across the country to seeing family, bride, there was
mail order brides,
they created families. It really, again, talking about the social movements, that these things you don't think about necessarily, but were a huge movement.
Yeah. It made possible for women to actually consider going to a different location to start over again, or to actually just start.
Go be a teacher.
Yeah.
Go do something else. And it wasn't frowned upon. They could get off the train without somebody rolling their eyes or whispering.
Yeah, because they were acceptable occupations that they could participate in and all of that. So it opened up the world.
Absolutely. Really. I really think, and almost you can't compare it. To something technology. I know the phones revolutionized the world. I know the World Wide Web did all these amazing things and horrible things. But really, this is a physical thing that affected the entire world at one time.
Overnight, because when that first train rolled into Grand Island on the 8th of July in 1866, it changed the world because all of a sudden you could order things from a catalog. You could send back east or out to the west to get something. Well, not to the west just quite yet. It's going to be another couple years, but you could go back east. You could order things. You could have the opportunity to get on that train and go see family and find out, maybe get letters in a more timely manner instead of waiting months and months on end, or maybe even a year. You might get it in a few weeks. Be able to send letters, be able to communicate, be able to send for family in Europe. All of these things became possible. You could get more objects. You could get,
even politicians.
Oh, they used
doing campaigns. Mm-hmm. Instantly you had access
Whistle stop tours yeah. became the thing. That's yes. how you.
And so politics took a turn at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that's how Teddy Roosevelt got here.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I hadn't thought about that. That's really interesting because, like, really up until that time, it was still kind of, you know, not popular for at least presidential candidates to campaign for themselves. They would appoint a team to kind of go out there and do it for them.
And they would expect people to come to them they would be on their place.
On the front porch, mm-hmm. and you can come talk to me. And, like, I have to be summoned to be president. I don't want to be seen to do that.
Right, yeah.
And I think McKinley in 1896 is the last one who actually does that. But that's, you know, right around that same time where you have to have that national presence, mm-hmm. and you're not going to get that national presence by sitting on your front porch anymore.
Mm-mm. Yeah, you have to go out and meet the people.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. You were mentioning just kind of like the overnight feeling of it. And I'm certain that the people living during this time in the U.S. were just blown away by the speed with which mm-hmm. this is. It's just kind of a cute story that, you know, during this, like, same time, 1830s, 1840s, before the Transcontinental Railroad's completed, if you read Ulysses S. Grant's memoir, he talks about leaving home for the first time in Ohio and going to West Point on the, you know, other side of the country. Uh-huh. And he's blown away by the speed of the train going 12 miles an hour. and it was a jolt to him. Like, he got, like, motion sickness from going 12 miles an hour on this train across country. And, I mean,
you could make a case that there was a physiology change in humans at that time.
Well, and they made the argument that if you went over a certain speed, you could get sick and all this other stuff, which, of course, was not really founded in truth. But they didn't understand the science of that movement, the rapid movement of the train could cause these problems. But think about, like, when you were a kid, the first time you ride a bike and you go off on yourself. You know, it's kind of like when the train first got here and you could actually go somewhere. You know, it's mm-hmm. that, like, giddy little moment that, wow, I get to do this.
Yeah, I'm free.
By myself, I'm free. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, kind of circle back to what we were kind of saying earlier, like the importance that they had for these communities, like the railroads themselves. They did more than just, like, provide towns with access to the world. They a lot of times built the towns themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yes.
Speaking in, like, Grand Island's case, where we are right now,
yes.
there maybe isn't a Grand Island without the Union Pacific Railroad.
If the route had gone any other way, chances are we would not. Now, it's advantageous where we are in proximity to the Platte, but would have it grown to the same standard that it is today? Because UP built because they made it a hub, because not only did we have Union Pacific, we ended up with the St. Joe and Grand Island Railroad, mm-hmm. and then Burlington Northern coming through, and then the branch lines going out. There was like a spider web going out from Grand Island. It's literally a hub in the middle of a wheel with all these different short routes going out from it. Now, yeah. UP or Burlington Northern ended up buying up most of them. But, you know, that's the way railroads worked.
Sure.
But it created all these communities. And then when they pulled back out of them, some of these communities declined. The smaller communities in the outer lands of Nebraska, they're not as big as when they used to have a railroad stop.
Sure.
So, you know, the railroad giveth and the railroad taketh away.
Yeah, and, you know, we're still living with that today, just even with those businesses that mm-hmm. it started, you know, like, we've talked on this podcast before about what towns needed during that time to kind of thrive. The Bartonback Opera House in Grand Island, you know, comes about around this time. Like, there were things that, like, made your community have roots that kind of started with the railroad, I guess, is what mm-hmm. I'm saying.
And the entertainment that the Bartonback brought, because it meant that Grand Island was more than just a community that you worked. You also could have entertainment that would come to you from across the country or the world.
And you could plan for it.
Yeah.
You could make dates. You could advertise. Mm-hmm. You could do a lot more than just, you know, wow, when anybody can get here.
Dances, socials. They did graduations at the Bartonback. I mean, they did all kinds of things. But a lot of it, you know, so you're reading all these stories of these different entertainers that came from different parts of the country or from Europe to give programs at the BART back. So, but they were brought here by the rail.
Yeah, and I mean, it's literally bringing culture to the community. Mm-hmm. And that's so much more than just, you know.
Operas and all these plays and everything. It's fun to look at all the things that came.
And you know, me, I always gotta have the dichotomy, also bringing crime.
Yeah.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
You know, we have plenty of fascinating stories about how if the railroad weren't here, there are things that wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, that creates that community, develops the values, develops the political system, and really is central to town building.
And that impact of the train remains strong until we get the automobile transportation. And even at the early phase of automobile transportation, there's still the railroad is still strong. It only starts to kind of go a little bit down, probably World War II period and after is when, you know, more people are driving and they start building the interstate system and all of that.
Yeah, and there's the large trucks that can be refrigerated and can have product. And.
But yeah, even the, you know, yes, it built cities, but I feel like especially because, you know, Sturm Museum is a county museum, it also built like communities amongst towns that were nearby to each other.
And they all kind of relied on each other.
Exactly. And, you know, like, again, we've talked on a previous podcast about Shimmer's Lake that was nearby here.
And there was a rail stop
exactly. to it. And like people came from Doniphan or they came from Wood River or wherever. And that brought them to the same place, even though they weren't from the same town and would have most likely not have interacted near as much with each other a generation prior because the railroad was there and available. It kind of led to that social cohesion, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there was railroad excursions to go to the fairs back in Omaha or Lincoln or whichever town was hosting that particular year. There were excursions out to Shimmers. There were excursions to the World's Fair that was happened in Omaha or to the fair that was in Chicago in 93. So there was all these opportunities for these different excursions. Again, you know, taking you to some entertainment, getting you, you know, in connection with the wider world.
Well, and being able to go as a family, mom, dad, you know, older children.
As the Meliassons did to the 76 exposition.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, and we have several journals that talk about their travels and moving around that way. Because before that, you know, maybe the father would have gone and written back, kind of like Stolle did.
Yeah.
But now it was more accessible and more legitimized, I guess, for children and women to be going to those things.
I'm just thinking of packing up the kids and putting them in the car and going on a trip. I can only imagine what packing up to go on a train excursion with your kids would be like.
My mom actually did that when we were little. We took the train all the way to Havasu City.
I was in kindergarten, my first train ride. It was on the Burlington Northern. It was kindergarten. They didn't think that.
Oh, I hope kids still get that opportunity. I don't know that they do. I know there's some passenger trains out there yet, but
it's mostly air travel though.
Yeah.
You know? And that's kind of what you guys were talking about reminded me of was, you know, well, we had these, not one, but a few very, very nice depots in Grand Island and they were everywhere, much like there are really nice airports today. And the people
and
take
some
a lot
not
of pride.
So nice airport.
Well, exactly. But like my point is like people, depending on where you were, took a lot of pride in the way that they were adorned and constructed, and Grand Island had
whether or not they had food,
all of this. You know, Grand Island has the eating house that is, you know, that's present that goes alongside of the depot, and there was just a central hub in Grand Island that was beautiful, and it was centered around this one mode of transportation for over 50 years.
Yeah, and there was a decadent side to that kind of travel. I mean, of course, again, there wasn't always that. Yeah. I mean, and it was only for a certain amount of people, just certain ethnic groups.
And the railroad itself became an entertainment because everybody would know when the train was coming
to town.
And they would go down and watch who was getting on and who was getting off the train or what kind of stuff was being... Who's getting shipments of stuff? So it was kind of like,
and it was reported in the paper.
Oh yeah,
and you know, and people were aware of like the impact that this had on their lives too. I mean, it's been a while since I've read this. I apologize. The movie Union Pacific.
Oh, it's been a long time. Yeah.
But there was a Union Pacific Day
in
Grand Island in 1939 celebrating the release of this movie and also just this sort of camaraderie.
Yeah, the stars from the movie were on the train. Yeah, mm-hmm. There's all kinds of stuff about that.
And it came out in 1939, which is what, the 70th anniversary of the completion at Promontory Point in Utah?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not good with math. I'm sorry.
I know. I'm using my fingers.
70 years. But yeah, it was a whole day. And like the premiere was in California. And like people, I don't know if we had it at maybe the
Capitol downtown.
Or it's, you know.
Yeah, I'm not sure which theater it was.
I don't know. I don't think it was the Grand. I don't think it was the Capitol. It was the Lida.
The Lida. Okay.
But it was the day. Uh-huh. Like it was a whole thing, and like celebrities were in town who were in the movie.
I think it's
been a while since I've read this. But there is a few articles that have been written on this. But like the director of the movie and I think a couple of actors from the movie took a train from California and went through town, and people saw them, and it was a whole thing.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
And people were getting autographs, and there was stuff in the paper, and I think there was even souvenirs available for it too.
Yeah, when we did for the 100th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad, we did a little section on that movie and how important it was to all of, you know, to the whole story again.
Yeah.
And that people still celebrate. I don't know.
So I guess.
I'm sure there'll be some anniversary coming up.
Right?
Oh, yeah, always. The fives and the zeros are the ones you want.
Yeah.
That's how you get people
Why
interested.
Do they have to do it in 69?
Oh, yeah. You know, if you had to say if there was one legacy that you would consider the Transcontinental Railroad to have on the lives of people in Hall County, what would you say that would be? Or is there one? In the everyday Joe walking down the street.
I think its impact of bringing the world to them and also their ability to go out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a long-lasting, yet we don't have the opportunity, not everybody has the opportunity to do train travel. It's still possible. You can still get up at 2 a.m. and go down and get on Amtrak and go east or west. But the ability to what it turned Grand Island into, how we grew, how we evolved, how we continue to evolve, because later impacts was we had the UP shops were built here. There was a massive roundhouse built here. And some of those original structures that were built in the 1880s still stand at the UP yards in town. I would not advise people to go down and try to look at them. Just drive by on the highway. You can still see them from there. But, you know, because they don't like a lot of extra people running on the grounds. But you could still see them and the impact and the number of people it brought to the community to help the community grow. I'm constantly, and when I'm doing research, running across all these people who were working for Union Pacific in some way, shape, or form. They were, for a very long time, the largest employer in Grand Island, Hall County.
Yeah, and it's, as you say, it still continues. It is not a finished story. It continues to evolve. It might be different than the dominance that it had back then, but it's still very much a part of even the shape of Grand Island and how the streets are formed.
And, yeah, they you had know, a big impact.
You're reminded of it sort of constantly. And I'm also just kind of drawn back to the Granville Dodge quote, where he's talking about just all of these different movements of people and nature
and
the world, and it just kind of naturally has followed this path. And that has really made us part of that story, even if you want to be or not, you just kind of are.
We're just here.
Yeah, everybody is part of that story.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think that, you know, it is also a huge lesson going forward as we're going to have more and more of these worldwide changing events, worldwide changing technology, climate change, whatever you want.
We don't know what the next big thing is going to be.
Right, that everybody is affected. And you kind of got to look at it and make sure that that's considered. And I'm not sure that was always considered you know, the benefits, the consequences, and all of that. And it's really a good opportunity to study and to enjoy that, but also to take those lessons as well into the future and see, you know, how can we round it out?
Yeah.
How can we benefit absolutely everybody instead of destroying certain parts of the land, mm-hmm. ignoring parts of the land, ignoring certain peoples?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, that in ignoring certain peoples, the impact
putting
that it
the
had
labor
on
a certain amount of peoples.
Yes.
And so I would encourage anybody, you know, come out to store, ask somebody out here about the railroad and figure out. It's an absolutely fascinating thing. Thank your railroad worker.
Yeah.
I'll tell my dad you said that.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'll tell my husband.
See, look at that.
With that, I think we can conclude this episode of the podcast. As always, I want to thank Carrie Stouffer, the curator of the museum, and Kay Sanova, the director of interpretation here at Stir Museum. I always love talking to both of them, and look forward to more episodes of the Stir Crazy podcast in the future. But until that time, thank you so much, and we will see you later. Thanks so much.